You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if Nick Saban yelled at us, we'd be honored. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you agree that Nick Saban and Doug Peterson should be celebrated for, as the kids say, clapping back at the media, clapping. Did I say clacking or clapping? I don't know. I can't say these slang terms. But if they should be celebrated for that, then you belong here in the midside, and your friends probably do too. So come on in, pull up a chair, listen to this fireside chat with JML, not FDR, and tell a friend to pull up a chair too. The nice thing is, unlike the fireside chats, these are pre-recorded, so you can listen to them whenever you want. You can listen, you can screen the good stuff, and then tell your friend to listen to all of it, because all of it is the good stuff. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello. Yeah, it's definitely interesting how much paternity leave we grant on this podcast. Daniel's out again.
Wait. I thought, and maybe I was wrong and Daniel's taking advantage of me, but paternity leave means once you're a father, you can leave and come back whenever you want, right?
Oh, I guess that's how it works. Well, at least I could console myself with Michigan's defeat this weekend, and as they lost to Notre Dame once again. I don't know how much more we can take.
Losing to Notre Dame is pretty depressing, but you're not Penn State, who almost lost to Appalachian State, so at least you lost to a Division I team. Sort of. All right, well, sort of, I think, sums up a lot of what is going on this week in the news. Let's go into that in the news without Daniel T. Richards.
Center. It really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
The news this week is sponsored by our Discord server, where we had so much news this week. We actually couldn't fit it all into the news segment. But if you join our Discord server, you can hear such stories as hear our discussions about such stories as white people food is creating an unattainable picture of health. You can hear our discussion of how social justice warriors are trying to use software licenses to restrict undesirables from using their software, and many more. So come join our Discord server. Links are in on themidside.com at the bottom of where we post all our links for every show.
I actually really liked the one where you pointed out that Labor Day was just virtue signaling in the history of our country. I like that because it always reminds me of the Don Draper quote from Mad Men, where Peggy's complaining she's not being appreciated for all the work she does, and he just yells at her, "That's what the money's for!" I mean, as a worker, I appreciate another day off. I don't have to go to work. While you're listening to this podcast on Midside Monday, I don't have to go to work. But at the same time, why do we need a day to recognize labor? That's what paychecks are for.
Yeah, that's very true. But we must virtue signal and quell the masses. So, our first story. Will Wheaton has a listening problem. Will Wheaton has left Mastodon, as an aside, that's a Twitter alternative, after facing pressure and hostility from both the community and the staff. Yesterday, Wheaton got BOFA'd. A BOFA is an adolescent prank named after its most popular iteration, BOFA. And Wheaton didn't take the prank well and immediately reported the user, a trans woman, for the prank. A brief muting by one of Mastodon's instances led to a greater discussion about pranking celebrities, especially celebrities who are being pranked for a troubling history with problematic comments and behaviors. So, basically, Will Wheaton, if you guys have been following the story, he left Twitter in a huff and decided that if they didn't ban Alex Jones on Twitter, he was going to let his account expire. And so he joined two alternative Twitter social networks, one of them being Mastodon. And he's actually been brigaded off of Mastodon, which is amazing. Justin, is this a sweet vengeance, or is something else happening here?
It's definitely sweet vengeance. It's also something else happening here, which is actually very tragic. But before we even get to that, I have a couple things I'm confused about. They named their Twitter alternative Mastodon, like after the prehistoric beast.
These are hives of scummery and villainry. Like these are very strange, like decentralized networks, which is great. I mean, that's all great. But there's a lot of crazy. If you think, you know, it's sort of like the difference between the amount of social justice on Twitter versus Tumblr.
So what, was Woolly Mammoth just too long for them as a name?
I guess. I don't know. So
it's very strange. It's very bizarre. And the second question I have is, what does referring to Bank of America do to piss people off? Like, why is it a prank to be like, Bank of America? Like, I don't get it. BOFA, Bank of America?
Uh-huh. So Will released a statement about his leaving Mastodon, and he said, I quote...
Wait, you're not even going to respond to Bank of America, BOFA?
No.
Okay, so what he's referring to is there's this prank, BOFA, where you say BOFA in a conversation until someone replies and says, what is BOFA? And then you go, BOFA these nuts! And apparently Will Wheaton decided to get mad at that, whereas if somebody did that, I would just be like, you're an idiot. Can we move on with our lives? I mean, that's like a joke that, like, I just made that someone like William would no-sell, like a Bank of America joke. That's what you do. You no-sell a joke like that. But the sweet vengeance question you were asking, William, It is vengeance because it's hilarious that somebody who said, shut up, is now being told, shut up, Wesley, especially because it's Will Wheaton, right? Wasn't it inevitable that this show would have a title named the Shut Up Wesley Edition?
Yeah.
Right, inevitably. But here's the dark side of this. People who are throwing in with social justice, they will come for you. There is no being an ally of social justice. It's only a matter of time until they come for you because no one is pure, according to them. And they always have to have another target in order to keep their power going. So they will always come for you. There is no being an ally. There is no being on their side, especially when Will Wheaton is a straight white male.
Yeah, to get back to Wheaton's statement, basically he ends up sounding like everyone else who is not in the social justice left who gets brigaded. He talks about he gives sort of the background of how his account was suspended because they got 60 reports overnight about his account. And at the end he says, I quote, I don't deserve to be treated so terribly by so many random people, so I'm not going to put myself in a place where I'm subjected to it all day long. I mean, it's exactly describing how people on YouTube and on Twitter get brigaded, basically where people come in, they take some quote, or sometimes just a completely made-up item, stir up controversy, grab the pitchforks, and take the hit the mob out and just try to flag their account until they get banned. And that's exactly what happened to Will Wheaton. And he's actually been on the other side of this kind of thing with the Alex Jones thing. That's what makes it so delicious.
Well, right. That's what makes it so delicious. But that's what also makes it tragic is that he was on the other side and he did not see this coming. He did not understand that the mob could be turned on him. And now that he does, he understands the proper response is, you know what? There's no point in being in this space. Eventually, this space is just going to be left to the trolls because to be rational, to be productive, to be healthy, you can't be involved in this space with this kind of behavior going on. There is no middle ground.
So speaking of people who don't recognize that appeasement is a good strategy, the big problem with Animal Crackers cage-free box redesign. The new art doesn't address any of the underlying issues about ethics, exploitation, and corporate greed. Nabisco's Animal Crackers are a staple of American snack food aisles, and the box, a red and yellow rectangle, featured brightly colored circus animals, cavorting in cages is instantly recognizable. Just last week, though, Nabisco's parent company, Mondelez International, announced it will change the design of the box. Instead of depicting the animals behind bars of a circus wagon, it will show them striding free along a savanna. Though the change is symbolic, it stirs up some mixed feelings for the author who wrote this, ethics-wise, as well as personally, because the designer of the previous box was my great-grandfather's brother. Swapping the art on the box doesn't address the real issues PETA raises, but it does do a disservice to my uncle's art and legacy. So this article goes on to turn the uncaging of the animal crackers on the box into a screed against the corporatism and artists that work for corporations. So, Justin, as an artist who works for a corporation, did you stand up and cheer when you read this article?
Yeah, I totally was like, you know what? Free the animals and free the artists from their cages. Down with capitalism. Hold on, let me go put on my Antifa mask. And don't tell Midsider Katrina I was the one who hit her over the head in Berkeley. This is the biggest bunch of socialist crap ever. This is a perfect example of how, you know, Will Wheaton learned that they will come for you. Well, this is a perfect example of it will never be enough. You have to stand your ground. Animal crackers, Nabisco, did not stand their ground. And they said, you know what? PETA has a point. You know, it's abusive to use animals for our entertainment. You know, putting animals in a zoo, that's bad. Let's get Shamu out of SeaWorld, right? That whole blackfish thing, like, oh, we shouldn't have Shamu in SeaWorld. That's unethical. They gave into that. And then what happened? The social justice warriors, they smelled blood in the water. They smelled that your dick was turning inward and becoming a vagina. And when they smelled how gross your vagina is because you're not washing it, they were like, oh man, these pussies, we can get them even more. And we can really push our full agenda, which is down with capitalism because we can't earn shit and we want shit given to us. That's all this is.
Yeah, the article is great because it lists all these supposed evil things, like in 2016 when they moved some of the production to Mexico, it gave workers a choice between moving to Mexico or staying and taking a 60% pay cut. And he makes sure to mention that Nabisco was acquired by, gasp, Philip Morris, the tobacco company, and merged with Kraft Foods, and then split into two separate companies. Like, it's just a blatant anti-capitalism screed, and it's hilariously off the mark.
Yeah, it's what I just said, to sort of take that joke again. They see these people becoming giant pussies that aren't clean, and they go, hey, we're douches, let us clean things up. It's just, fuck these people. It will never be enough. Do not apologize. Do not give an inch. It will never be enough. To quote Jean-Luc Picard, ironically, because he's one of these people who is with them now, the line must be drawn here, this far, no farther. And go watch First Contact if you want better delivery of that line.
So we have even more examples of people trying to incite the hate mob. This time the target is In-N-Out Burger. Left-leaning fast food fans lose appetite after In-N-Out Burger donates to California Republicans. Cult fast food chain In-N-Out Burger is getting served after it was revealed the restaurant chain donated $25,000 to the California Republican Party. Journalist, who cares what his name is, found the filing this week and posted it on Twitter. California Democratic Party Chairman Eric Bonham called out for an In-N-Out boycott. The late CEO, Richard Snyder, was an evangelical Christian and supporter of Republican candidates, and current president, Lindsey Snyder, is also devout. Like cult chain Chick-fil-A, In-N-Out doesn't make its founders' Christian values a secret per se. Customers just might be so focused on their animal-style burgers that they don't notice the references to Bible quotes printed on the wrappers. So, one last fact that's important to know, it comes at the very end of this story, is that they also donated $30,000 last year and $50,000 this year to Californians for Jobs and Strong Economy, a political action committee that supports business-friendly Democratic candidates. Justin, should we boycott In-N-Out?
Yes, because it's terrible.
Well, that's easy. So not because they're supporting Nazis?
What? Where did you just go on that one, dude? Nazis? No, I get what you're going for. Look, In-N-Out has Bible verses on their wrappers.
I usually get my stuff animal style, so I think it's probably covered by the sauce. So I've never seen them.
I get them plain, and I've never seen them because I'm just too busy thinking, why am I eating this crap every time to actually look at the wrappers? So that's interesting to me. But first of all, there's the possibility here that In-N-Out is just supporting their business interests, and they're not Republican or Democrat. They're just supporting the candidates that are going to make them the most money. So that's the first thing. The second thing here is the boycott idea. The third thing is the Democratic guy. I'm going to talk about that in a second. But the second thing here is the idea that you would boycott somebody because they do something with the money you give them that you don't like. You are not giving money to Republicans by eating at In-N-Out. When you go to In-N-Out and you buy a burger, you are giving money to people who make burgers that you like, make burgers that you think are good. That no longer becomes your money. They can do whatever they want with it. So you are not giving money to Republicans. You are giving money to people who make good burgers, in your estimation, but you also don't understand what a good burger is if you're giving it to In-N-Out people. I'm just going to keep ripping on In-N-Out in this section. The important thing is to remember they can do whatever they want with that money. So what if they go and they go to the zoo? Are you going to, or they go to SeaWorld, right? Because it's In-N-Out. So you're in San Diego and you go to In-N-Out. And so you're giving money to In-N-Out. And the manager is like, I'm going to take my kids to SeaWorld with my paycheck this week. Did you just support animal cruelty and animal, I was going to say indoctrination. What's incarceration? Because you gave money to a company where one of the employees goes to SeaWorld. You are never, ever going to get away from the idea, get away from the truth that somebody that you give money to in a fair trade is going to go and use that money to do something that you do not like. And if that's your justification, you're going to end up just trading with yourself. That's it.
Yeah, if I have to vet every person I give money to make sure they do something that I find acceptable with that money, like the whole, the whole system just breaks down, right? Like the whole idea is that you as an individual know what's best to do with your money. And that's the same thing for companies. Companies are just individuals that got together and started cooperating in a specific way. So if they want to donate to both parties, one party, some crazy, Greenpeace organization, that is not going to enter into my calculus when I go fetch a burger. Now, when it might is if they're if we're moving somehow towards fascism, then that might enter into the equation. But do you think, Justin, that there's so many people in California that think we're moving towards fascism that even a minor donation to the California Republican Party represents some sort of existential political threat?
Well, that's the third thing I was going to say. I don't know if you did that intentionally, if you did, good job, but this is the bullshit.
Thanks a lot. I'm doing two-thirds host duty here, and you're like, I don't know if you did this on purpose.
Good job. I appreciate it. Yeah, that's exactly where I was going, and I appreciate that you understood that. Is that guy, whoever the fuck he is, like, he's stoking the fires of fear. I mean, we hear all this crap of like, oh man, if Trump says something negative about a company, like, that's a de facto boycott and that's illegal. The president shouldn't be able to encourage boycotts. That is projection, because that is everything the left does. Everything Democrats do is they tell you, oh, what this company is doing is wrong. We should boycott them. So now it's okay. It's okay that the Democrats are doing it, but Trump just expresses that he doesn't like something and people get up in arms about it. It's hypocrisy. Do I want the president just popping off at the mouth and being like, oh, well, you know, I don't like them, blah, blah, blah. No. Trump has his own fucking problems. We all know that. But this fucking problem over here where this guy's like, hey, they donate to people against me. Wouldn't it be cool? Because they're on the other side's unethical to everyone boycott them. If you don't see he's trying to socially shame you and manipulating you into A, supporting him, and B, trying to take the money away from his opposition, then you're a fucking idiot.
Yeah, that's really all this is, isn't it? I mean, you can see the Democrat quote about, you know, basically quoting Caesar there, A tu Brute sort of thing. They just want to make sure that only they get the money, right? You shouldn't. Yeah, I mean, it's California. How much do you really need to donate to the Republican Party? I mean, maybe in San Diego where they're headquartered, because there's Republicans actually have a chance down there, but not in Sacramento, not statewide. So, yeah.
Only Orange County. Orange County is really the only place where you have to worry about Republicans in California.
Yeah. Well, we have even more people that are out of touch with reality.
Making shit up to scare you.
This is from NPR, believe it or not. The school shootings that weren't. How many times per year does a gun go off in American school? We should know, but we don't. This spring, the U.S. Department of Education reported that in the 2015-2016 school year, nearly 240 schools reported at least one incident involving a school-related shooting. The number is far higher than most other estimates. But NPR reached out to every one of those schools repeatedly over the course of 3 months and found that more than two-thirds of these reported incidents never happened. We were able to confirm just 11 reported incidents, either directly with schools or through media reports. In 161 cases, schools or districts attested that no incident took place or couldn't confirm one. In at least 4 cases, we found something did happen, but it didn't meet the government's parameters for a shooting. About a quarter of the schools didn't respond to our inquiries. When we're talking about such an important and rare event, this amount of data error could be very meaningful, says Deborah Temkin, a researcher and programmer director at Child Trends. So, Justin, should the government be counting? And if so, how do we get them to count correctly?
Well, the second question, I have no idea how to answer that question. I mean, if you can figure out how to get government to do things correctly, then you can revolutionize the world. You can revolutionize the history of mankind. So I can't answer that second question. Should they? Sure. I mean, they want to keep track of things, but there should be other companies and other organizations keeping track of this. I mean, I would want to know, and maybe you know this, William, but I would think that the NRA keeps track of these sort of statistics as well to show the other side of things.
You know, I don't know that for sure, but it does make sense. I know that that's one of the talking points from a lot of gun rights activists is that these shifting definitions of what is a school shooting completely inconsistent. It's hard to get good data on this stuff. And also, they're not as frequent, which also makes, because they're rare, it's also hard to get statistics for. Aggregate statistics and draw any good conclusions. And yeah, I think it's important that we have other groups that are independently gathering this kind of data. I mean, that's usually the role of academia. But I think the lesson learned here for everyone is you cannot trust blindly government statistics, right? This seems like it should be easy to count, right? Just like NPR did by comparing news stories, because obviously a school shooting is going to make the news. And then, you know, actually calling the people to confirm the numbers. Like this was not Emmy winning reporting, right? Like this was not Pulitzer Prize level investigative journalism. This was just simple confirmation of the data that you have. And it's something like 0.2% of schools were reported by the education department as having a school shooting in that time period. And the numbers are just wrong. I mean, that's what the NPR shows.
The thing is that this is very, very scary. It's very scary for one specific reason. This is a made-up statistic that can only have one outcome. It can only have the outcome of people wanting more gun control, which amounts to government taking guns away from us. So when the group that is giving you the statistic is giving you a false statistic that takes away your ability to fight back against the group, you should be very, very scared. This is just an excuse to fan the flames of gun control activists so that they can take away our guns. And I'm saying that I don't even own guns. I'm saying that just knowing the whole purpose of the Second Amendment. And that is what's scary, especially considering there is two greater problems in this country. One, we saw with the Florida shooting, where how many times was that fucking guy reported? And how many times did the FBI drop the ball? And then it was similar in the most recent shooting as well, in Baltimore, where that guy also...
Well, that was in Florida as well, but he was from Baltimore.
Oh, Florida. He was from Baltimore. Sorry, I just assumed shooting Baltimore. Right. So the guy from Baltimore, and that was in Jacksonville, that guy was also reported multiple times for mental health issues. So one, we don't know how to deal with mental health. Two, we have background checks, but why is there no mental health component to these background checks? So we have these two problems, but instead, we're going to make up statistics. We're going to make up statistics to fucking scare us into giving up our guns. If that doesn't scare you, that people would do that, it's fucking terrifying. Now, to be fair, I want to ask something about this article. It says that they called these schools, and the schools either said there weren't shootings or they couldn't confirm there were shootings. What does that mean, they couldn't confirm? Because that seems to be a large part of the argument here.
That's interesting. That's a good question, because I think part of it is that the question, like they talk about the details of the article, like the questionnaire changed slightly. So I think it was more general, like incidents involving a weapon. And some of the statistics may have been skewed because people were putting that in the wrong box. And instead of actual, you know, discharge of a firearm with or without injury, which is a different standard as well. And I'm just thinking back to, like, you know, when I grew up, especially during hunting season, it wasn't unheard of. I can think of three incidences and where people would accidentally have their hunting rifle on their truck and drive into school and have to go into the school, and they would, you know, call their parents or whatever, you know, make sure that it wasn't left on school property, right? But today that would be, you know, instant expulsion, right? Same thing with knives. You know, you have a lot of people where I grew up. I grew up in a very rural area, if that's not obvious, where they would have knives as well, because you would get up in the morning, you would take your knife and you would go do work, and then they would go to school, and people would accidentally bring in knives and also have to go to the office and say, oops, I brought my knife today. Here it is. And again, that would be another cause for instance expulsion in today's world.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I mean, whatever that means or not, as far as can confirm or not, because exactly of all these details you've just said, which again, we don't look at the reality of these situations. We just put a number in a box and then we get scared and we say, take our shit, take our lives, control us. It's just...
So I have one more question for you, Justin. Yeah. So when we see this statistic quoted, because you know it's not going to stop, is anyone going to... I mean, this is NPR pointing this out. Like a little bit of media play-by-play here. This is NPR calling out the statistic not being correct. Like, are we going to see a Snopes article claiming that there were 3,000, you know, gun incidents in schools in 2015, 2016, right? Like, who's going to actually point this out to people? Because you know politicians are just going to make hay about this statistic and say, oh, it's from the federal government, it must be correct.
Well, and that's a greater problem in our country. All you can do out there, Midsiders, is you hear someone talk about this, just say, well, actually, NPR did a study that showed that the large majority of those supposed incidences didn't even occur. They called the schools and said the schools said they didn't occur. They couldn't confirm they occurred. And then if they don't want to hear it from them, they're not a convincible audience and you just have to move on. Because you're exactly right. Like, Snopes isn't going to do this. The media isn't going to do it. Politicians aren't going to do it. People are going to use what they want to their advantage. I mean, we still hear nowadays that Brady cheated in Deflategate. We still hear that the Patriots are spying on people. The people who want to use this are never going to stop using it. You have to have the information and talk to the people that are willing to have their minds changed by reality. And speaking of that, and we're talking about people getting offended and mad about things that there really are no purpose and no reason in getting offended or mad about, it's time for The Hopeful Romantic with JML. So, William, I don't want to do a review this week because I want to talk about something that hits pretty close to home here in the Midside when we're talking about art and movies. I want to talk about the supposed controversy around Damien Chazelle and Ryan Gosling's new movie, First Man.
Yeah, I saw we had a little discussion in Discord about it. And so I think the basic controversy is that it's not the American flag. That they're using the Armstrong family crest sort of flag as part of the biopic for Neil Armstrong. And this angered the identitarian / offended community on the right and generated some stir. So, Justin, what do you think about in a biopic taking something and not having it exactly be the same as what happened in reality?
Well, this has to do with the reason this hits close to home is this has to do with our love for the romanticism of Damien Chazelle, right? When we talk about Whiplash, when we talk about La La Land, he very much understands the purpose of art, and the purpose of art is selectively recreating reality. Now, in this specific instance, people are upset that they're not going to show the planting of the American flag on the moon. That's a decision they made. Now, this movie is from the perspective of Neil Armstrong. This isn't from the perspective of the American public. This isn't from the perspective of the American president. Thank God it'd probably just be him doing drugs and fucking Marilyn Monroe while Neil Armstrong was actually doing something. It's from the perspective of Neil Armstrong, played by Ryan Gosling. And that had to be taken into account when making the movie. You do not need to show things exactly as they are. Romanticism is as much about the choices of the artist as it is about the choices of the characters, what you choose to show and what you choose to not show. And Chazelle said exactly this. That was exactly my thing. I'm reading this. Actually, Midsider Motive Power tweeted this at us. And I responded to him using the shrug emoji, and I was like, this seems like pretty objectivist to me. Like, this isn't right. This isn't left. This is just, we're going to make a romantic film, and this is what we're going to do. And then Chazelle said exactly that. He pointed out that we are going to be showing the American flag on the lunar surface. We're just not going to be showing the planting of it. And then here's a direct quote about his reasoning. I wanted the primary focus in that scene to be on Neil's solitary moments on the moon, his point of view as he first exited the LEM, his time spent at Little West Crater, the memories that may have crossed his mind during his lunar EVA. This was a feat beyond imagination. It was truly a giant leap for mankind. This film is about one of the most extraordinary accomplishments, not only in American history, but in human history. My hope is that by digging under the surface and humanizing the icon, we can better understand just how difficult, audacious, and heroic this moment really was. First of all, William, I mean, he's defining heroism as accomplishment and productivity. Is that allowed in this day and age? Or are people just going to get mad about this quote? Now did he piss off the left?
I kind of hope so, in a good way. I mean that honestly. Like, this is exactly what I would want to hear out of a filmmaker. This is the exact kind of response I would want to hear out of a filmmaker. This is the opposite of all the things that we just talked about in the news. Someone standing up for their integrity. It's a very Rourke moment, right? And it's also interesting to me that everyone who's been criticizing the film, they haven't seen it, right? And now we do a fair bit of that in the next segment where we criticize trailers and try to decide whether it's worth seeing or not. But this is different. This is hearing secondhand accounts and not even really understanding the context of the film and drawing these conclusions about it being anti-American, which is probably not true. I've even seen people say that the reason they don't emphasize the planting of the American flag is so that it will sell well in China.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter as well, which was just fucking bizarre to me because I don't think any of Chazelle's films have sold in China. I mean, do you think La La Land was marketable in China? What about La La Land is marketable in China? These fucking goofy Americans dancing around and talking about how amazing Hollywood and artists and dreamers are. Is that going to sell in communist industrial China?
I don't know. That's a good thing to try and figure out how it did internationally, but it's it seems a very, normally we're kind of jaded when it comes to interpreting filmmakers, and it wouldn't surprise me to make money based decisions. We know what studios do to filmmakers, but in this case it seems like he's getting his vision across, and it's been well received at the screening in the Venice Film Festival. So I think it's okay to have high hopes for this film.
Yeah, it's definitely okay to have high hopes, especially with this quote. I mean, just the sentence, I wanted the primary focus in that scene to be on Neil's solitary moments on the moon. Like, using that as a principle for how you direct and write those moments, and that's why you don't show the flag. It's just incredible. From even if you don't ultimately like the film or he doesn't execute as well as he would have liked to, the fact that that's how he approaches filmmaking is incredible. It's just great that he sees it that way. And I actually have to wonder, William, do you think somebody at Venice Film Festival saw this, released that information on the internet because he knew it would undermine the film, that if people saw it as anti-American, it wouldn't do as well as the box office? Do you think someone wanted to have bad PR for this movie because it's a pro-human achievement movie?
There's that jaded sensibility that I'm used to. I don't know. It's distinctly possible, but I think that when people say I'm going to do a movie about Neil Armstrong to the general public, I don't think it's unfair to expect to see that segment, right? The whole planting of the flag. That was important to everyone else. But once you understand that this movie is about Neil Armstrong's point of view and showing how heroic that whole journey was, that changes it. And I think it puts it in the right context to understand what's going on and why those choices are made in the film. So I'm excited to see it.
I'm excited as well. I mean, we love Chazelle here. He's put out two great films so far. Absolutely love La La Land. Love Whiplash a little bit, not as much as La La Land. But it should be good to see what he comes up with next. And interestingly, you mentioned and hinted at Trailer Takedown and how we look at these movies and, we talk about them even though we haven't seen them. But the thing you talked about is firsthand versus secondhand. And I think that's really important. It's the idea that we're looking at the materials being shown to us by the studio who want us to see this movie. So they're saying this is the best case for seeing this movie. And we're taking it and we're saying, would we see this movie based on their best case? So I don't think this is anywhere near the same thing that is being done. And I think that's important, being done by these people speaking out against First Man. I think that's an important distinguishment to make, because for Trailer Takedown, the intent for me is to put myself in the seat of a moviegoer and show what my process is for deciding if I would see a movie or not, if it was worth my time. Is that your similar approach to it, William?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to see if there's a hook that gets me interested in seeing what happens in that universe of that film.
Right. And we, of course, want to hear what you all think as well about this stuff. That's why you should go on the website and watch the trailers, midside.com/podcasts. And you can see the trailer takedown preview for every week. And you can watch the trailers before you start this episode. You can watch them during the episode, or you can watch them as we talk about them on the episode. You can watch the first one, pause, listen to the episode, pause the episode, watch the second one, so on and so forth. You can make it more interactive. And if you really want to make it interactive, you can sign up for our Patreon, patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/Patreon. And by supporting at a certain level, you can become a Discord member, and by becoming a Discord member and a Patreon supporter, you can help us pick content for the show, such as Trailer Takedown. So there's a lot you can do to become a more active member of the Midside community, to become a more active Midsider, and we love all of you who do that.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
The Other Side of the Wind is Orson Welles' final film. Apparently, it has been worked on by Netflix, and it's finally ready for release. I didn't really get a good idea from the trailer what the story is. It just seemed to be a movie about making movies, sort of like a meta movie. Although the trailer didn't seem to distinguish if this was a movie about Orson Welles himself or not. It was a very strange trailer in that way. I know when Daniel does Trailer Takedown, he likes to read the summary of the plot of the movie to talk about the trailer, but I think you need to look at the trailer on your own. So as far as looking at this trailer on its own, I was wildly confused, and there was honestly nothing about this that interests me. And to be flat out honest with all you Midsiders out there, I've never actually seen Citizen Kane, and I have no desire to. I have a feeling it's one of those movies that's hyped up, and if I were to see it, it would be boring as shit. So this is a tackle.
Tackle.
William?
Justin, I thought exactly the same thing about this movie, and we'll talk a little bit about similar confusions in the third movie, but I had no fucking clue what this movie was about. There was no hook, unless saying from the person who created Citizen Kane is a hook. I have no idea. This looked like, is this just a, like, Hollywood masturbatory fantasy? Like, I have no idea what this is. And if this was supposed to draw you in and hook you, like, I don't even know what's the conflict. What are we interested in? Is it the struggle to make a movie? Is this the movie? Is this the making of the movie? I have no idea. So this is a hard tackle.
Tackle. Second trailer.
I Think We're Alone Now is the film version of the Fox sitcom Last Man on Earth. In it, Peter Dinklage is going around his little town or little city, which looked like it was England, I thought, which I guess maybe makes sense because they just shot it there in between seasons of Game of Thrones. And he goes around there and he finds Elle Fanning. And then they go from house to house to see if there are any other survivors of this sort of, I guess, apocalyptic event, although that's never revealed in the trailer what it is. That was sort of the one thing that hooked me in this, was I was sort of like, I want to know why everyone disappeared. Somebody tell me that. And there was a couple lines about like, oh, well, what were you doing when it happened? Or sort of like hinting at that they survived because of what they were doing. But largely, I fell asleep or almost fell asleep during this trailer. That's saying something, William. This is a 2-minute trailer, and I almost fell asleep. I had to like wake myself back up. Now, that's not to say Peter Dinklage isn't an amazing actor. He is, and he did well in this trailer. But is the material he's given particularly appealing? No. So unless you want to watch Peter Dinklage do a good job acting in a stupid movie, there's no reason to see this. Tackle. William?
All right, I have a little bit of a opposite take here. I looked like some interesting shots. It was a little slow. I'm not necessarily against slow. Maybe I've had more coffee than you today. The
I don't drink coffee.
There were two hooks that kind of got me. The one is, like you said, the mystery of the universe that they're in. Like, why is everyone dead? And what were they doing when this event happened that didn't affect them? And then the second was sort of this conflict of not trusting the only other person in the world, right? There was some hint at that as well. So I'm going to give this
I thought they just didn't – she just didn't trust him because he was a midget, because he was a dwarf.
It was because he's a man.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that makes
because
sense.
Because we know the
How did he just not rape her? I mean, she's the only woman left. He has his urges. There's no one around. I mean, if men are toxic, toxically violent, how is like this movie just not called I Think We're Alone Now, So I'm Gonna Rape You?
Well, we all know that the reason everyone's dead is because of toxic masculinity. But joking aside, I didn't see any overtly crazy identitarian or tribalist things in this, so it looked like an interesting story. So I'm going to give it a tentative hug.
Hug. Final trailer.
Airstrike is a movie about fighter pilots starring Bruce Willis, and that's all you need to know. I think, William, you hinted at this. I didn't really understand this trailer, and what I mean by that is he leading a group of Japanese-American fighters against the Japanese in World War II, or is he an American leading the Japanese against the Americans in World War II? It wasn't really clear, but then the trailer used the typical movie trailer guy, and it's like, in a world where you don't know what Bruce Willis is doing, but there are fighter jets, this one battle will turn the Second World War.
The Second and Great War.
Yeah, the Second Great War, sorry. We don't say world anymore. World is oppressive to people who don't live in this world. There are other people in the universe. So it's the Second Great War. But it said that, and I was like, is there really a battle I've never heard of with Japanese fighter pilots in World War II? Or is this just some weird promotion for Eminem's new album, Kamikaze? So I completely admit that the plot of this movie makes no sense. At least of this trailer makes no sense. I have no idea what the fuck's going on, but it's the same thing where I was just talking to my girlfriend today about going to see a movie, and she was like, oh, Mile 22, what's that about? I was like, it's a Mark Wahlberg action movie. I don't need to know what it's about. And it's the same thing here. This is a Bruce Willis action movie. I'm in. Hug.
Hug. William?
So I have a question for you, because I had to watch this three times to piece it all together. Here's what I think is happening. I think it's the Chinese fighting the Japanese. And the reason I picked up on it is there's different visual clues about the kinds of planes and what they're fighting and stuff like that, because they're definitely fighting the Japanese, because they're Zeros. And those do look like American planes, but it seems like Chinese imagery on things. So I'm not 100% sure. My second, I have a question for you, though. Is this a remake or is this an original story?
I don't know. I'm going to look that up as well as the summary, because I think this is one we need to read the summary of, because I feel super racist right now because I feel like I just said all Asians look the same. There are Chinese and Japanese in this movie.
Well, I think it's a good point, though, because it's not clear. They didn't really frame it properly in the actual trailer to know what's really going on. It's going to turn the tide of World War II. Like, the Second Great War. And I think if this ends up being what I think, then I have a second rant to go on. This is definitely one of those made for Chinese audience movies. But
William, it was actually made by a Chinese audience. So according to Wikipedia, Airstrike, also known as Unbreakable Spirit, is a Chinese action war drama film directed by Zhao Feng about the Japanese bombings of Chinese city Chongqing during World War II. Mel Gibson joined as art director. The film stars Lu Yi, Bruce Willis, Son Sung-hyun, and William Chang. I'm just trying to pronounce these Asian words as correctly as possible so I seem less racist.
I think you're just digging the hole deeper at this point.
Look, I watched Crazy Rich Asians Searching and To All the Boys in one weekend, and I hugged this movie, so fuck off.
Yeah, we know you have yellow fever.
That's 100% correct. Undeniable.
So this hits all my good buttons for action movies. It's got Bruce Willis. which is automatic trump card in many cases. There's guns and there's things exploding in the air without lens flare. So I'm all in on this. Hug.
Well, I'm with you, but I don't understand the plot. Like, so is Bruce Willis part of the Japanese? Like, I don't understand. The Japanese were the bad guys.
The Chinese were being oppressed by the Japanese all during the buildup and during World War II. So I think this is the Chinese fighting against the Japanese.
And Bruce Willis is on the side of the Chinese fighting against the Japanese.
Yes.
Okay, so does he speak Mandarin in this movie? I mean, that might be worth the price of admission on its own. Bruce Willis trying to speak Mandarin?
Hey, he's throwing shit around in the preview. That's all I need to see. I don't care what he speaks.
And also the idea that Mel Gibson is the art director on this movie is kind of cool.
Does that mean everyone will be in Braveheart makeup? Or right, that they'll be super gory shit like in Passion of the Christ.
Isn't Braveheart pretty gory too? Like when they're like trying to pull him apart, right? Yeah. Don't they like string him up and try to pull him apart? I remember that being pretty gross.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. We know one of the things we love as part of our life is Bruce Willis, but that doesn't mean life is always easy. So sometimes we have to talk about things, talk about ideas and how to get through some issues. Let's do that now in Life on the Midside. William, I mentioned to you in Discord something earlier this week that I really want to talk about because it's something that I've noticed and I sort of want to identify it and then talk about how do we avoid it. And I don't even mean as a culture, I mean individually, because as a culture, we have a problem. We always talk about entitlement in this culture, but I think that it's important to talk about everyday entitlement and what that means. And the reason I came up with this phrase, this concept to distinguish between generally this abstract idea of entitlement and the way somebody has an everyday entitlement is because of something I noticed. So I was driving through a Walmart parking lot, and what I noticed is people will step out in front of the cars without even looking. And the reason I call this everyday entitlement is they're not thinking of the possible consequences of getting hit by a car. It's just, I'm going to walk out in this road and a car is not going to hit me. And the reason I'm pointing this out specifically, this example of the car walking out in front of it is, this isn't even an issue of crossing or looking both ways before you cross the street. This is an example of all you have to do is walk behind the car. So me personally, I know it's safer when I'm walking through a parking lot, unless the car is backing out of the spot, to walk behind the car. Because that way, I know what direction they're going and I can go behind it. But people will see a car coming towards them and walk out in front of it. And to me, this is representative of what I said, everyday entitlement. Is this something you see too and you also think is an issue?
Yeah, I wonder how much of it is, I do see some of that. And sometimes it comes off as a kind of like pervasive narcissism, right? Like there's no one else in the world and I shouldn't take into account other people in the world. You know, I have to continuously clean the part of the yard that's between the sidewalk and the road. From, you have to pick up dog shit all the time, just plastic stuff that collects, right? People just throw down and leave there. And also those bird scooters, people leave them literally at, like, you have to trip over the exit door to get out of my place of work in order to, you have to trip over several bird scooters because people don't put them, you know, they don't park them in a place that people wouldn't trip over them. And it's just, I wonder how much of it is this unthinking sort of narcissism versus what I think you're trying to get at, which is this, I'm entitled to these things, right? That I deserve these things without any particular reason, just because I'm me.
Right. And the difference, William, between what you're saying and what I'm pointing out, because I picked this example for a very specific reason. I'm glad you brought all that stuff up because it really points to the difference. And the difference is the entitlement to their own safety. What I'm talking about is when I'm out and about, I believe that I am responsible for my safety. So I take measures when I'm walking, when I'm driving, when I'm doing whatever, to make myself as safe as possible. These people, when they're just walking out in front of cars, it's like their safety is just a given. They will be safe no matter what. They don't have to take the extra steps. And that's why I'm considering an entitlement versus the narcissism you're talking about.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know that there's a lot of people feel entitled to responses from people, right? You see that all the time when people engage in conversations on social media or even in person. They feel entitled to a particular kinds of response or even having certain words be used because it's them, right? And I think that is a small building block that just continues to grow in people, that they feel like they feel like the world owes them something, and this nebulous sense that is really doesn't lead people to take that individual responsibility, which then unlocks your potential for happiness.
Correct. So then the question for me is, and I'm going to provide an answer, and if you have a different answer, I'd love to hear it. But the question for me is, how do you make sure you don't slip into this everyday entitlement? And for me, it's just to be reality focused. As one of the things you were just talking about, William, expecting responses from people. You don't expect responses from people because the reality is other people can decide what they want to say and what they don't want to say. So you don't ever slip into the entitlement because you know reality is what other people have the ability to do or not do. And it's the same thing with the situation that I'm describing about the way you walk through a parking lot. You focus on the reality of the situation, of what the dangers are and what the possible outcomes are, and then you respond to them accordingly.
Yeah, I think for me, I actually, this is something I've been thinking about since we started talking on Discord about it. I think that for me, I see that I struggle with the opposite, where I actually could be more assertive in the people realm because I, not that I'm entitled to something, but that it's just to engage or get a particular response from people, that's a matter of justice. So sometimes I have to work on that, being a little more assertive with people. But for things, yeah, I think it's really important to stay reality focused and take responsibility for, understanding that other people can make their own choices and that things are not always under your control, and really knowing that, you know, down to that metaphysical versus man-made thing, right? Like knowing that, hey, some of these things can be changed, maybe not by me, but it's important to take responsibility for those things.
Yeah, the things versus people is actually a very interesting dichotomy as well, because it brings out, as you said, the metaphysical versus man-made. And that's where the difficulties that you're talking about, I share the same difficulties socially. So that's a little bit different, and it's interesting to bring that out. But I don't think what you're talking about is really the opposite of entitlement. It's just knowing when is the appropriate time to wonder if people are actually exercising their right to speak or not, or whether they're just not thinking about it. And then how do you politely get them to think about it without seeming like a dick?
Yes.
All right. Well, I think that sums up the discussion of everyday entitlement, unless you have something you want to add because you think I'm just being entitled and moving on to ending this episode. I will take the silent.
Yep. I think we're entitled to an ending.
Okay. I was going to say I'll take the silence as consent, which may get me into trouble in other elements of life. Hmm. But what did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that a little person is not enough to get Justin to see a movie.
you better be a big old person if you want me to see a movie. Wait, no, not that kind of movie.
Justin, what did you learn?
I learned what Mastodon is, and I'm going to soon be launching an alternative to Twitter called Woolly Mammoth. All right, well, if you enjoyed this episode, you can help us out a couple ways. We already mentioned at the top, telling a friend. You can also go to patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon. That's the best way you can support us, especially because MoviePass is dying now and I'm going to need money to see movies. So if you want to have me keep doing reviews, kick in a couple bucks on Patreon. You can also buy a t-shirt from the store, themidside.com/store. I know Midsider Alfred has bought a bunch of t-shirts, and I really appreciate that, to know that there's somebody out there who's basically decked out in Midside gear. That's amazing. And you can also give us 5 stars on iTunes. That always helps put us to the top of the charts there. So when people search Welcome to Thee, they don't find out about Night Vale or Beehive. They find out about The Midside. Is there anything else you want to plug, William?
No, just join our Discord server if you get a chance. It's open to everyone. And for you Patreon supporters, you get access to some secret channels. So join us on Discord. You can have fun with us all week as we witness the farce.
I love how the gay guy was like, "There's secret channels." Is this some kind of gay thing?
Well, we do do a homosexuality check. You're not invited to that channel.
I am not in that channel. That is correct. William does make all the channels. So we're also going to make a GIF of William just being like, "Join Discord, join Discord."
It is so much fun.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Wisniewski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
What are you laughing about over there?
Sorry.
She just said sorry. She gave me no content for the bumper here at the end. Do you have anything you want to say for the bumper, William? It's not even going to record William saying no. I already shut off the recording.